Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Whenever you're ready.
Welcome to the televised revolution, as we drift through outer space aboard the Absolution. With Tom back in active duty as captain, in charge of bringing superior anime action. Yeah, you came to the right place if you have a taste for animation in deep space base. Broadcast through your television due to the progress of the Bring Back Toonami Twitter mission. The same block that brought us Sailor Moon and Dragon Ball Z is back, so stay tuned. I remember way back, never leaving my room. I stay glued to my TV weekday afternoons. Yeah, and thanks to Adult Swim, I have a reason to use the TV in my room again. Cause every night I'll be tuning in, since they going back to showing action tunes again. Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Yeah, Toonami's back, bitches. Wait, did you say Toonami's back, bitches? That's the official hashtag if you missed it, to celebrate Tom's return to television. Welcome to the Anime Action Fan Sanctuary, with Tom providing that slick commentary.
Hark ye, Toonami faithful. Tis the Tom's Prerogative Podcast, right here on Ye Absolution Network. Tis I, your host, Thomas Mattis, your narrator, your guide, your journeyman for this evening. And on this ye episode 84 of The Prerogative, we go back to 2007 and review an anime that may be one of the best of its decade. I am, of course, talking about the wonderful anime Romeo x Juliet. Yes, my faithful Toonami listeners, on this episode, episode 84, we are reviewing 2007's Romeo x Juliet. And I'm very much looking forward to this for many reasons. And to answer your second question just came up, no, I'm not continuing to talk in the ye old English voice, because trust me, it's hard enough to do as it is. I'm not going to be able to do it for an hour. That answers that would really simple, but that'd be a funny way to entice you and enter the show. I hope you enjoyed it. But yeah, just that fun. That's the type of mood I'm in after watching it. It's going to be a fun review. There's so much to talk about. So much of this series is just shows great examples of what to do right, whether it be an animated movie or an animated series. And I will be making comparison to, especially in regards to, you know, I talked with friends about a certain movie has come out and gotten into a debate about its ending and stuff. And there's a great example in this that I'm going to be able to bring up when talking about scene work and stuff like that. So much stuff to talk about in this review. We have no comments. Again, you guys, as soon as you send them in, I can read them. Whether you send them in on the site, you send them in by email, send them in on Facebook, multiple ways that you can do it. So when you guys send them in, you know, I can do it. But you know, we have none of that to talk about. So for the most part, we're going to jump right into it. Like I said before, I find it interesting. You know, again, this is an anime that came out in 2007. And considering the anime that sort of overshadowed this anime, unfortunately, I find funny to be Tepa Tenge Gurren Lagann. The series I was supposed to review last week until, you know, as I made note of last week at the beginning, when I cursed and immensely at them. All the sort of review stream sites have taken down the English dub, hence why I didn't review it. I actually did plan on reviewing Romeo Romeo and ex-Juliet after this. And because the initial plan was, okay, I'm going to review Gurren Lagann, and for the most part, especially if my view on it stayed the same, which, I, especially if just watching the first episode in Japanese, I kind of had the feeling it was. But, you know, if it did remain the same, I knew that Romeo x Juliet, especially considering that it came out the same time as Gurren Lagann, would have been a great sort of complimentary piece to show, well, here's what they did wrong, and here's a series that did it right. And so I just find it interesting that it came out literally the same season as Gurren Lagann, and for obvious reasons was immensely overshadowed. Which I think is completely unfair, because by far, this is the better series. In fact, this is probably one of the best series of that decade, from 2000 to 2009, as I'll get to later. In fact, I'll just say it right here. If I made my list of the best anime, or for that matter, for the top five best animes from 2000 to 2009, and yes, this is an opinionated list, based on my opinion, so take it for what you will. But I'd go from 5 to 1, I would go Big Wind Up at number 5, Nodame Cantabile, the entire franchise, at number 4, Princess Tutu at number 3, Romeo x Juliet at number 2, and with Kaleidostar at being number 1. I just love Kaleidostar that much. Obviously an opinionated thing. But yeah, it's definitely one of the best animes of the decade, and just immensely overlooked. And like I said, it's going to be very, very much that ye olde English now affecting me. Yeah, that. See, I used to use the excuse that it was my southernness that, you know, messed up my speaking. Now I can use the excuse that I just spoke in ye olde English. That's affecting how I'm talking. But it's going to be fun to look at really what makes this series good, because there's such in-depth to talk about, from the music to the animation to the acting in the dub cast, which is just phenomenal. And the story itself, which is just wonderful. You know, as I said kind of before, I think, you know, a more appropriate, you know, or should I say, this series says it's based off the play by William Shakespeare. I think a more appropriate term is based off the plays of William Shakespeare, because in watching this series, it's obviously the influence of all of William Shakespeare's plays in this series. So with that, let's get right into it, shall we? And let's start off with our synopsis, in case you don't know what it's about. Romeo x Juliet, based off the plays of William Shakespeare, starts 14 years ago from the present time that our story takes place, on the floating island of Neo Verona. Leonatus Montagu and his men lead a bloody coup and murder all of the members of House Capulet, the rulers of Neo Verona. However, one survivor, Juliet, was able to escape thanks to a group of Capulet loyalists. 14 years later, and in our present time, or present day for this series, mind you, Lord Montague is now the new prince of Neo Verona and rules the land with an iron fist, crushing anyone who opposes him. Juliet, now a 16-year-old girl, fights against House Montague with a Montagu's oppression by becoming the masked vigilante known as the Red Whirlwind. While attending the Rose Ball hosted by the Montagues with a friend, Juliet meets Romeo, Prince Montagu's son, and they fall deeply in love with each other on first sight. What follows is a story of revolution, of hope, of tragedy and triumph, and how true love truly conquers all. This is Romeo x Juliet. And welcome back, and let's get right into it as we always do with music. And we're going to start off with the opening and closing themes of Romeo x Juliet. And oh my god, this opening theme. Lena Park, it's basically You Raise Me Up, yeah, which is a very famous I want to say church song. Yeah, and I'm like looking for the music here. Inori, oh god, let me go into my music file because it does have a Lena Park, my god, belts this song. The song itself is just absolutely glorious. Inori, You Raise Me Up. It's basically the title of it. Or I could look right there. But my god, this quite frankly may be one of the greatest anime intro themes of all time. The beauty, the gravitas, the raw emotion that is just felt through this song is so glorious, and oh my god, I tear up just listening to it. It is so wonderful to listen to. Like I said, Lena Park, just, oh my god, just because of this song, I will buy any CD she releases, because my god, her singing is just angelic in this song. One of the best ways I can actually describe this song, and this is just a huge compliment as far as I'm concerned, is this is very much like, or at least has that same feeling and emotion of the songs at the end of the Disney animated film during the 90s did. For instance, you know, Beauty and the Beast, you know, you have Beauty and the Beast that was sung by Angela Lansbury in the movie, but then during the credits, you know, Celine Dion and blanking on that name. It's not important at this point. The Whole New World during the credits, for that matter. You know, you had to like, you know, I can show you the world, but then they're like, I can show you the whole world. You know, that type of song, and it's the same thing, you know. That sort of gravitas, that just a raw emotion that you would hear, correct, were just angelic and just belting it with all her emotion. It's so wonderful and amazing. It's heartwarming and heartbreaking, and it brings tears to my eyes. It's so beautiful to listen to. And it does the, in its grandest and greatest way, it does the, like I said, always, the one thing an opening theme is always supposed to do, get you ready, get you hyped to watch the episode, to watch a series. And by leaps and bounds, this opening number does that. As much as I can sit here and talk about how glorious it is to hear the song by itself, it does exactly what it needs to do. Because there is the shortened version, which is, you know, I have both versions, so I have the shortened TV version that is used as the opening, and then the longer full version. Both are gorgeous. The way they do the shortened version, and having that, you know, you heard it right there, because I used the actual end of the full song, mind you. But, you know, the way they have that sort of merge where she just, like, really lets go on that one line. Oshiete! You know, that whole part right there. Oh my god, this is a glorious sort of short version of it, but it does pale in comparison to the longer, just great version. And it's not just her belting it, it's also the music, this sort of, you know, the use of the guitar in the piece, it's just wonderful. Combined with the piano and sort of the band here, a combination of full orchestra with a guitar and a piano, oh, it just blends wonderfully and perfectly together, and it's beautiful to listen to. And not to be left out are its closing themes, which by far are not going to compare to the opening, because it's just, it's one of those things to where, you know, it's not going to be fair because it's so grand, it's so beautiful, it's one of the greatest of all time. You just can't compare it. It's like, I don't know, comparing Santino Marella to Shawn Michaels. You know, Shawn Michaels may be the greatest wrestler of all time. Santino Marella is never going to be him, but his work is good. It's sort of the same thing here, though probably not the best comparison to anybody who is a wrestling fan. That being said, the closing songs are wonderful, and I love what they are as well. I love that for the first half of the series, you have this sort of really just great rock track called Cyclone that is just wonderful. It's done by 12012. It was the ending theme for the first 14 episodes. It's just this great heavy track, just a wonderful melody to it. The band, wonderful to listen to. The use of the internet. It is just a great closing song for the first 14 episodes. And then Goodbye Yesterday, which is this more melancholy sort of song that's used for episode 15-23. There's an English version of You've Raised Me Up, actually sung by Lena Park, used at the end of the final episode, which was just as wonderful. And I do believe it's also the song that's used in episode 7. I could be wrong. That could have been Funimation. It's just one of those things where just the music is great. And part of the reason I love the two closing themes here is, again, like I said, that rock track, you're in that middle of everything building up, and it's that the rock sort of ending sort of fit that feel to the series. And then the sort of more melancholy Goodbye Yesterday by Ms. Rock sort of felt that sort of that upcoming tragedy that you knew was coming. And sort of it fit those themes that were happening in these two different parts of the series. Then you have the overall score. Now, with the overall score, it's just a grand thing. Absolutely. Wonderful, wonderful sort of Western-style score. And when I say Western style, I'm talking Western as in sort of European Western score. It's not like an American sort of orchestral Western score that's more bombastic, like a John Williams or a Hans Zimmer or something like that. Here, it's much more of that sort of classic European orchestra grandeur and gravitas. And it, oh my god, it just works perfectly with the series. And more importantly, in the important scenes where it's just used wonderfully, the music is there and it enhances the scene, but at the same time, it doesn't overpower it. That great balance that I always talk about for it to have, to where it needs to be powerful, it needs to enhance the scene with emotion and everything, but at the same point, then doesn't overpower the scene. The music is there, you know it's there, but and this is also due to the fact of a great story and great dub acting and great animation, it doesn't overpower. In fact, that's one of the great things about this series, is just the great balance between the music and the animation and the story and the acting, for that matter, both Japanese and English, though I'm going to be talking about the English when we get to acting. But the music is just wonderful. The score is just amazing. Definitely a pickup if you're into music. Just such, you know, great use of so many different tones and the way it helped portray the emotion, because emotion is a big part of this series. It's what lends the weight to scenes. It's what lends you to believing in what's happening and caring for these characters. It's just a wonderful thing to watch, and sort of the vessel that a lot of these emotions are carried through is the music. It's what, or should I say more importantly, the music is sort of the tuner. It's the amplifier to these emotions that are being displayed on screen. that is just such a wonderful balance that's needed for that, and it's done to perfection here in the score. So, music, oh my god, is just amazing. From top to bottom, whether it be the opening and closing themes, to the actual orchestral score used in the series. I will admit, to somebody who is maybe more used to what's considered classic anime, which is strange to me because I really don't think there is something that considered classic sort of comedy anime or stuff like that. They might find the opening themes kind of strange, but I think if you really look at them and really understand what they're doing with them and how they work, they're just absolutely amazing. So music is just, to put it in a way, 5 stars for me. So with that, let's move on to animation. Again, Romeo X Juliet was done by Gonzo. Same people did Kaleido Star. I do believe they're the same people who did Princess Tutu. Don't quote me on that. See a pattern here with Gonzo? The animation is just incredible. I mean, oh my god, it's just incredible. It's amazing. It's the decision to go with sort of a shoujo style of sort of the, which is again that, you know, the soft colors combined with the thin black line work works to absolute perfection here, and it is glorious. And not only just soft color, but sort of soft watercolor type of feel to it is just wonderful. From the character designs to, you know, backgrounds to everything, the overall style is just wonderful and beautiful to look at. Like I said, that soft sort of pale coloring to, you know, where you have like reds and blues and all of this, but it's toned down. It's not toned down too much, though, to where there's a sort of brightness within it that makes them pop out while still being sort of toned down and oblique and sort of that type of feel there. And again, like I said, that those soft colors along with, especially within the character designs, the thin black line work, give it sort of this real great realistic feel to the characters, along with, you know, things like animals and especially all the moving parts, just works wonderfully within the animation. That goes on as we move on to character designs. Oh my god, I love the character designs. All the character designs are wonderful, from Francesco and sort of the ladies' man, Golden Lux, Flair, to, I have to look at my names here, Curio and sort of the Scar, and I'll get to Curio in a second, but let's start off with, of course, Romeo and Juliet. You know, Juliet is, you know, is just such a wonderful female character design. You know, for, you know how everybody seems to talk about that what they want a female design to be these days? Well, this should be the design that they are holding up on a stick that says, see, this is what you need to be drawing. Because if what they're talking about is true, Juliet is one of the greatest female designs of all time. Now, I'm not saying it, but I do think it is one of the best. Okay, that came out completely wrong. I don't think what they're saying is necessarily right, but I do think that this is one of the best character designs for a main female hero of all time, because it is just wonderful. And one of the great things I love here is, and again, this is why that choice for the shoujo style was such a perfect decision to go through, was, again, both her male and her masculine and feminine qualities within the character design that allowed it, so when they, like, had her hempy and short hair in the series, she had that sort of masculine quality to her. Yet when she let her hair down, there was that feminine quality. And it was much more than just, you know, hey, oh, she has long hair, she's a female, she has short hair, she's a male. There were qualities that they were able to play with within facial expressions and nose and the way her body was drawn, to where even when she had short hair, there were times where she was a bit more feminine. Even within blushing and sort of character emotion, the facial animation, which was just great, mind you, and sort of more moments where she had the long hair, where she was more masculine, and that sort of dual feature there. You know, we see the same thing in Sora in Kaleidostar. And again, it's just an example of, especially when you really want to connect a character with especially both genders, this is our really take a way to do it. I think you see the same thing with Relina, Peacecraft, and Gundam Wing. I'm trying to think of some more modern tales where this takes place. But it's one of those things where whenever somebody has the, I'm going to say here and say, kahunas to do it, it works so well. Another reason I think it's also a bit of an Easter egg here, because again, you have that sort of masculine qualities, sort of almost a throwback nod to the, you know, the fact that, again, in William Shakespeare's day, women weren't on stage. So again, you have that almost that sense of, you know, you have a male playing the female lead to an extent when her masculinity, when her masculine qualities are more on the forefront in her character design. And, you know, she's with Romeo and all those aspects to it. So I sort of love that aspect to it. I feel it's like this sort of nod and this throwback to the, you know, again, the days of old, of William Shakespeare, where, you know, we discriminated against women and only had men on screen, therefore men had to play the parts of women. Oh, God. This is going to come out so wrong, isn't it? Moving on to Romeo, and Romeo, the same way. Romeo is just an absolutely wonderful, almost damn near perfect male character design, especially in regards to the shoujo style. The aspect of both combining, those feminine and masculine qualities within him, but they work it in a different way, but they work it to perfection. Again, and a lot of it deals with sort of that facial animation that they do so well in this series. And then all the characters are just wonderful for that matter. Lord Montague, just from the moment you see him, he is just a villain. That design screams villain, and I love it. Because there is no point that you should like this character at all, especially considering what he does in the series. It's just wonderful. Ophelia's design, because you see her more towards the end, and again, who is this character? Is she friend or foe? That sort of neutral feel to her character design, especially considering that she's in all white, and sort of the villainy that you feel in that is just wonderful. Tybalt's design, I love just the use of black in his design is just wonderful. Of conveying that sort of mysterious character, and where is he? Is he neutral? Is he not? Is he on our side? Is he on their side? Where does his loyalty lie? And just that feel to that. And then also sort of the difference between the designs of the Capulets and those who are on the, for that matter, the side of the Montagues. You know, when you look at, like, Lady Hermione and Mercuso, for that matter. Sort of that air of nobility and the royal and, you know, somebody who's been living for a long time in the line of royalty and in the noble lifestyle to, you know, the Capulets who had been, not necessarily among the rabble, but, you know, who had been living a more harsher life, living a life of work, you know, the more chorus sort of feel to their character designs. As to the more sort of smoother, slim aspect, the more noble aspect of the character designs of those who are with the Montagues. There are these little subtle things in the character designs that I find just absolutely fascinating and wonderful. And they just, again, they add that depth, they add that detail to the story, to the emotion that's going on. It makes you believe in the characters. Again, with Curio, that him having that scar on the eye is a perfect example of how you're telling a story within the character design. And mind you, they tell the story of how he got the scar in the series. But again, that, you know, here's somebody who's seen war. Here's somebody who's been down the weary road. You have a sense of respect for him in seeing that he's lost his eye and that scar there. So there's story being told in the character design that I think is absolutely wonderful. So, with that, let's move on to action animation, for that matter. And the action animation is just wonderful. The choreography here is just superb. Just the right amount of action within each scene. The sword work is pretty, you know, it's very reminiscent of sort of those great sort of sword fighting scenes that you would see of the, you know, sort of great swashbuckling pictures of like Robin Hood and the pirate movies of the, you know, the 50s and the 40s and someone to the 60s. Something that was tried to be brought back recently, of course, with the Pirates of the Caribbean movie franchise as well. But that sort of great sort of sword fighting tradition that we see in cinema, you can feel that influence here. And just, again, the great setup of, you know, Francisco shoots an arrow, the way it sort of pulls back, and then the camera pulls back from him and lets it go, and then cuts to it happening. And just sort of great presentation within the action scenes. Whether that action scene be, again, like I said, a sword fight, the shooting of an arrow, or something as simple as just, you know, flying on a horse and then, you know, they're trying to escape. There's also a sort of great play presence to this that I love, that's sort of very reminiscent of William Shakespeare. Again, indulging in that theme, indulging in the source material, indulging in being influenced by the source material, that, again, just adds to that depth that's in the animation that enhances the story. And so the action animation is just wonderful and superb, and it just got a great blend to it that I absolutely love. With that, we then go to backgrounds and special effects, and oh my god, the backgrounds are beautiful. Just the way the watercolors, you know, sort of blend with each other to give it that sort of almost photogenic look to it. Photorealistic, I mean, look to it. It's just amazing. And just all the different locations, from the mines to the village that Romeo tries to copulate, to sort of the towns outside of Neo Verona. But the other thing is also Neo Verona itself is that, and mind you, they do visit some of the places later in the series, but there's a thing that, like, through the first, I want to say, 15 episodes, it is something to where, you know, you feel like you're not seeing all of Neo Verona. This ability to go in different places and feel like, you know, you're in a completely different place, and yet you may be just around the block from a location that you were last episode. So this entrance to new locations, and again, the ability not to just reuse the same location over and over again, it just that it's that added depth, it's that extra level of realism, that extra level of skill and effort there that just, again, immerses you into this story. It immerses you into this location, into it being real. It's just so wonderful to watch. The backgrounds are gorgeous. And then the special effects from fire and that, again, just sitting out and drawing them out, mind you, is just done wonderfully. The amount of craftsmanship here in the special effects, from the shadows to the weather to, again, just the simple, like, sparks flying off swords, the special effects here is done wonderfully, and it just blends with the animation so wonderfully. So just all around, again, when I look at animation, all these things that just add levels of depth and immersion into the story, again, being that great balance, as I said before, it shows you why you have this great depth of balance between the four parts that's required to make it just a solid and wonderful series, and all the things it does to enhance the story. Again, it's one of those things that if I had to rate the animation, I would say 5 stars! So that's it for animation. It's just wonderful to look at. speaking of stuff that's sort of wonderful, it's time for a commercial break. I'm going to play a promo for a couple friends of mine who I want you to check out. And when we come back, we're going to get into acting and into story.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
My name is Michael Bailey.
And I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And we host a podcast called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
Presented by the Superman homepage. On the show... Wait.
What?
This just isn't working out for me. It's not bombastic enough. We need something epic.
Like what?
Welcome to From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast, presented by the Superman homepage. I am Jeffrey Taylor.
And I am Michael Bailey.
From Crisis to Crisis chronicles the adventures of Superman.
Wait. I'm just not feeling this.
I'm just wondering how there's a needle scratching sound when all of this is clearly digital.
Look, all we need to say is that this is a trailer for a show called From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by the Superman homepage. My name is Michael Bailey.
I'm Jeffrey Taylor.
And every week we give in-depth synopsis and reviews for just about every Superman book published between Man of Steel number 1 in 1986.
And Adventures of Superman number 649 in 2006. We also talk about the related Superman media, what was happening in the rest of the world when these comics were published, and what else was going on in the DC Universe.
The show drops every Thursday-ish at the Superman homepage, which is located at www.supermanhomepage.com.
From Crisis to Crisis is also a proud member of the Superman Podcast Network, located at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com.
So join Jeffrey and I each week as we explore Superman during the post-crisis era, which includes Exile, Panic in the Sky, Doomsday, The Marriage, and beyond.
And write into the show at FromCrisisToCrisis@gmail.com and hear it read on the air, eventually, because we get behind on that sort of thing.
Superman created by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. Side effects from Crisis to Crisis include loss of money from buying back issues, a desire to read 20-year-old comic books, nausea, drowsiness, pizza, blurred vision, upset stomach, a desire to kick puppies and kittens, and backache from lifting boxes of Superman comics. If the excitement of From Crisis to Crisis lasts more than 4 hours, seek immediate medical attention.
I guess you weren't so tough after all, were you? Now it's time to send you to the next dimension.
291 original episodes.
This can't be. It's still going on.
325 manga chapters.
You act innocent, but you're deadly.
Time to die!
Dozens of characters, hundreds of enemies, and a whole lot of violence.
That kind of violence is pointless!
You see, Super Saiyans tend to be a bit violent.
Oh, crap!
Join hosts Donovan and Jesse as they cover the arrival of the Saiyans, the journey to Namek, the battle with Frieza, the mystery of the androids, and the terror of Majin Buu. The Next Dimension, a Dragon Ball Z podcast. Join the fight at dbznextdimension.libsyn.com.
See ya.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at TwoTrueFreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
And welcome back, and let's get right into it, shall we? First, let's go over our cast list, and we have a pretty big one here. First, we have Brian Palencia, voicing Juliet, Chris Burnett as Romeo, Colleen Klinkenbeard as Cornelia, Sean Michael T. as Benvolio, R. Bruce Elliott as Conrad, Eric Vale as Francisco, Robert McCullen as Curio, Mike McFarlane, no relation to Seth McFarlane, voices Tybalt, Maxie Whitehead, who sounds like he should be in an Adam Sandler animated movie, giving me a technical foul, voices Antonio, Christopher Bevins as Mercutio, Carrie Savage as the Lady Hermione, Donna Saltz as Lady Portea, Larissa Wolcott as Amelia, J. Michael Tatum as William D. Farnese, Jamie Marchi as the demigod Ophelia, and Sean Hennigan as Lord Montague. So, all these actors, and where do we start? Well, why don't we start right at the top with our two main characters. And my God, Branna and Chris do an absolutely wonderful job as Romeo and Juliet. And before we go to that, let me start with this. Their ability to use sort of old English language and sort of that play language, I know to a lot of people is very surprising. They love how it was done. And mind you, I thought it was a great touch, and it gave it sort of that William Shakespeare play feel to it that I thought was absolutely wonderful. I'm not at all surprised that they were able to do this, however, because this is Funimation, this is Houston. I know that, like, I believe Funimation's in Austin, or it's in Austin or Houston, I can't remember which. But again, it's that Austin-Houston area voice actors. Those voice actors used not only by Funimation, but by ADV. We're talking Greg Ayers, Lucy Christian, Chris Patton. You know, all of these actors here, I know for a fact, have great extensive play work in plays and in tons of just work on stage. I lost my ability to speak there. I apologize. So, it had to be hard because you wanted to make it sound right, but I have no doubt that they were able to pull it off because, again, you're talking with, again, it must have felt like just doing a play, except that you're in a booth and you're speaking your lines. And you have to match the flaps. You know, beep, beep, beep. Hark, baby, off! But that cast aside, Chris and Branna do a wonderful job with their characters. My God. Branna's Juliet is strong and independent and fierce and wonderful, just the voice. And, you know, just the great range of emotion that she's able to show in Juliet, from being seeming fragile and, you know, lost to just being moving up to that sort of leader quality, to being a leader, to leading a city in revolution, the great range there that she was able to show. And the same thing for Chris as Romeo. Their range here is what makes the character so believable. It's what makes you fall in love with the characters. It's just absolutely grand. They were just perfect as Romeo and Juliet. And then you have our supporting cast. I would personally say led by Colleen Klinkenbeard, who did a great job as Cornelia. We seemingly have been... by the way, if Brian Peninsula sounds familiar, we, covered her before and about... couple months ago in October when we had our Halloween sort of thing, and we reviewed Rosario Vampire. She was a Miss Booby Bums Kuruma, a Koromo Kuruma, the succubus with the booby bombs. And again, that's something that I love. I love watching different animes. Like, okay, so here she's playing Juliet, and it's a great sort of classic performance here, and then we have Miss Juggs. To put it lightly. And it's just... That range I love to see. And Colleen's no different. Again, she was the older Mocha in Rosario Vampire. We saw her last week in Trigun Badlands Rumble. As sort of that female... name's escaping me, and I apologize. But she did a great job as Cornelia, as being sort of that older sister slash mother to Juliet. And lending the support that way. And that's what, again, I could go down the list here, all these supporting characters, and what they were able to do that lended so well. But everybody did just such a wonderful job in their supporting roles. Bruce Elliott as Comrade was just wonderful as this sort of older, stern taskmaster. Eric Vowell did the wonderful job as sort of that ladies' man, with the brains of the operation. Robert McCullen, just, again, that sort of... at first I thought he was Christopher Sabat. I'll be completely honest. I thought it was Christopher Sabat voicing that character. Which, I mean, as nothing but respect for him. Because he had that sort of great sort of voice that Christopher Sabat does. And is perfect for playing characters like this. And I thought he was wonderful at it. So you had that, and then you also had, I also want to talk about J. Michael Tatum and Larissa Wolkoff, because they were supporting characters, and they played sort of a different supporting role than the other characters. While the other characters were more serious, they were the comedy relief, which is very much like a play to where you have these serious scenes, and then you sort of have, to put it in a lightly term, you have the clown team that comes out and gets a laugh to, cut through the seriousness and give that sense of, okay, I'm bringing you back to a base, and that helps us really believe in the story and lends its way. J. Michael Tatum was just amazing as William de Farnese, a.k.a. it's William Shakespeare in the series. It's like Stan Lee in a Marvel movie, for that matter. And Laura Wolkoff is Amelia was hilarious. I thought what they did a great job. And again, their role as being, again, sort of that clown team that brought that much needed comedy to the scenes to tone it down. And again, give the characters a moment to breathe, give the audience a moment to breathe through the series that was going on, really helped the series along. Then you have our villains, our antagonists, per se. We have a few. I'll go through the... you have Hermione, who, again, she's really more neutral. She's an antagonist, for the most part. But, it's just... I don't know where to put her, but I thought it was a great job. I thought Carrie Savant did this great job of training this character that so desperately wants Romeo's heart. So badly wants to be with Romeo. She knows that it's an arranged marriage, and no one can be happy to arrange marriage, but she's so in love with him that she wants his heart, but can't have his heart. And to see the sadness and how it drives her insane. And you're just waiting for her to snap. And again, this is something we'll get into the story, but the fact that she doesn't snap is an amazing aspect of her character. And I thought the way Carrie Savage was able to portray that was just wonderful, because that had to be an amazingly hard thing. You had to portray the character in such a way to where you're expecting this character to snap, to this character to go insane. And to an extent, she almost does. And there's a great scene between her and, between Hermione's character and Juliet's character, When, she's been saved by Juliet, and Juliet's taking care of her, and, Juliet's on the run from Lord Montague. And it's just this great scene between them that just works so well. The real big villain here is Lord Montague, and Sean Hannigan just does an absolutely wonderful job here. Oh my god, he plays the villain, just this hard-nosed dictator, this unrelenting power, and yet adds a depth in his voice to the character that knows you, that he has such sorrow in his life. There's that bit of sorrow that he adds to the character's voice. You know that sorrow is there, that even if you don't know his story, and we do learn his story later in the series, but even in the beginning of the series, you know, this character's had something tragic to happen to him to twist his mind. It's almost like a version of that, you know, that super villain tale, like Electro. You know, Electro, for the most part, is a character that, and again, Crispin Friedman did a wonderful job of portraying this in the Spectacular Spider-Man cartoon, which I kind of know a little bit about. it's just those tragic characters, that something tragic happened to them that twisted their mind, twisted their logic, and just made them evil. And Sean Hannigan does a great job of putting that little bit of sorrow in that voice, where there's a small part of you that feels bad for the character. You hate the character. You despise the character. And he plays a great job of doing the villainy wonderful. There's a scene to where, Lord Montague is holding a grape and he's talking about, it's all right to, crush them if we choose. And it's just, oh, and it was wonderful. It was great. It was wonderful. It's gorgeous. So overall, again, the acting, all of it was just amazing. And the thing that's great about this is everybody was great, and everybody sort of leaned on somebody else, and everybody, from Brianna leaning on Chris, and Chris leaning on Brianna, as Romeo and Juliet playing that great couple and making us believe in their love, to the supporting cast, to the antagonist and everything. And the way they were able to portray it in that sort of very sort of William Shakespeare play-like language just was absolutely incredible and wonderful. That, once again, if I had to rate the acting in the series, I would say 5 stars! Somewhere, Maddie J is smiling. I don't know where. I know it's in Canada. Oh, Canada, our home in native land. Moving on to, last but not least, the story. And there's so much to talk about here. Let's talk about the main theme of Romeo and Juliet, which is true love. I mean, it's the main theme of the play itself, and what they do here. Again, true love, how love conquers all, that even to the point to where that even in death, and again, spoiler alert, Romeo and Juliet die at the end. P.S., by the way, spoiler alert, Darth Vader is Luke's father. again, that's that story of true love, that love conquers all, to the point to where the even in death, their love is so grand and great that they are together even in death, and their love is internal, or is immortal and eternal, I should say. That being the focal point of the story, there's all these little things that are going, these sort of subplots. The way to use the subplots, and we'll get to that in a little bit, that lend themselves to eventually lead to all these tragedies happening. There's a part that, again, these subplots, something happening in this episode here that lends itself to something that happens later in the series, and that's all great and good, but if you don't have a solid theme and you don't do it wonderfully, and it's not written wonderfully, it's not, all that's not going to fly, because, again, that main theme's going to fall flat, And by far, it doesn't fall flat. The love of Romeo and Juliet is... because the emotion is there, it just works so well, and the writing is wonderful, and the scenes that they have them bring together are glorious. And really, the big thing that they have that does this is something that I think is not used as much in... not just anime, but I think in a lot of media, and I think people really don't appreciate it because it's not used correctly. It's intimacy. And I'm not talking about sex, I'm not talking about love. I mean, I'm talking about love, mind you, but I'm talking about sitting the characters down and showing them in an intimate scene. And that doesn't mean showing them in sex. An intimate scene is something to where, you know, you're with these characters and you're showing something to where just why they work so well. I think a wonderful scene in this is when Romeo and Juliet are running away from Neo Verona. And, you know, they land and they get attacked by the robbers, and of course they're able to, both of them are able to defend themselves and everything. But in the process, again, also Romeo is talking about his connection with his dragon steed. And in the end, you know, you see that he knows he has to do something, and you know, Juliet being there, and mind you, that entire episode has so many intimacy scenes. But at the end of that scene, his decision to basically let his dragon steed go to, of course, be with, you know, his beloved, which kind of doesn't, well, I'm not going to get into it. Considering the dragon seed met the female horse like 2 seconds ago, and somehow they're in true love, I just want to go up to Romeo. I'm like, Romeo, it's not true love. It's spring, and your dragon seed is Well, we can't say that on a PG-rated show. But moving on. but there's a lot of these great scenes of intimacy. Again, that same episode, a scene to where, you know, they're just waking up to each other, laying next to each other, cuddling, and, you know, seeing how them being with the other just makes them happy. Intimate scenes to where we get to peer into the emotions, and again, the emotions being the overlying theme here that makes the intimacy work. This is what carries these scenes and makes them so grand and makes you care and love for these characters. It's, again, that's what does it. The intimacy and all these little intimate scenes that we see in every episode of the characters, where it's just, we are allowed into sort of the private thoughts and the private moments between the characters, whether it be a scene in, with the character alone and what they're thinking, or it be when they're together and their happiness. I think the point, too, is, again, and again, this goes into all those sort of subplots, talking about how the series weaves its influence from the plays of William Shakespeare, because, as I said before, you know, when you watch the series and that title card comes and says, based off the play by William Shakespeare, I think a better thing would be to say, based off the plays of William Shakespeare, because that's really what it's about. Because the influence here of, you know, the William Shakespeare plots, whether it be that the characters' names are taken from different William Shakespeare plays, to little Easter eggs here and there that reference other, you know, plays like The Merchant of Venice and, you know, Othello and Much Ado About Nothing, and, you know, Juliet saying, I was lost in a midsummer night dream. The fact that, you know, at the end she sort of has the fairy wings that are very reminiscent of the fairies in A Midsummer Night Dreams. And those are little Easter eggs. But again, characters, again, diving their individual stories, sort of deriving from the different plays, whether they be Hamlet or King Henry or, you know, again, certain moments in there to where, like, for instance, near the end, Juliet's sort of revolutionary speak has this sort of same vitriol from, you know, King Henry, you know, who be with me, ye men, ye merry merry band. I'm completely blanking on the line, I apologize. Because I don't have it in front of me. But, you know, things like that to where, okay, here's a scene that's sort of more channeling this play. And again, it does it in a wonderful way. The main story is still being Romeo and Juliet, but these individual scenes and the emotion within them being taken from different William Shakespeare plays. And I think, again, it lends itself to that depth. It's that immersion into the source material that, as somebody who is a fan of William Shakespeare plays, I love absolutely. Last but not least, let's talk about one of the most important things that does really happen in this series, is that all of that is important because, again, they use emotion in scenes so much. And what that does is it adds real weight to the scenes. That's what makes every scene work so well. It's just, again, the intimacy, the emotion gives weight to the scenes. Every scene is important. You know, and there are, not to say there isn't throwaway scenes, but even the throwaway scenes are important because they give you that breather that you need from everything that has been going on, and that little bit of breather for you to relax. Again, it's not real. And all those things that breather scenes are supposed to do. But for the most part, every scene, and even those breather scenes, have real weight to them. That lends itself to it being real. That lends itself to you caring about what happens to these characters. Scenes like Lancelot's sacrifice, being burned alive. Scenes like Mercutio watching his father be slayed by Lord Montague. I talked about all the intimate scenes with Romeo and Juliet. The scenes with Lady Portia. All these scenes to where, again, there's real emotion going through them, and it adds weight. Again, this is also because the voice actors believe and portray that emotion. The animation enhancing it, the music enhancing it. There's real, raw emotion going through every scene, and it adds a heavy weight that makes it feel real. And because it feels real, you care for these characters. You care about all of them, not just Romeo and Juliet, but all of them, but especially Romeo and Juliet. And that, the thing is that for all the great weight that happens with all the characters and how great supporting they are, that focus on Romeo and Juliet, the focus on their love, and again, them being the focal point, which everything does happen. Because that's the thing, is that the weight allows for the focal point to go through those two characters. And it works so well, to the point to where everybody's doing something. And that's something, again, I made mention earlier about me debating about a movie. The movie is Frozen, which, again, I do plan possibly to review next month if it comes out on DVD. Hell, when it comes out on DVD, I'm probably going to pick it up and review it then. That being said, one scene in particular I've sort of been debating with a lot of people is that final scene. And one of the things is that that the character, Kristoff, seems to disappear in the final scene. He does nothing. And he's just not there. And my issue, again, I think people misunderstand it. It's just, he could have done more, and it could have added more weight, more realism, more emotion to the scene. And I use this as a perfect example. I look at, which scene should I use here? I'll go with it. The final scene, you know, where Romeo and Juliet, and they're about to sacrifice, but you have the characters, you know, Crucio and Tybalt and Francisco, and they're there. They don't need to be there, but because they're there, they need to do something, and they're added emotion there. Of them desperately wanting to save them, but Juliet, they know, go, and then being forced to go. The real weight of a consequence is about to happen there, and just the raw emotion being there, being portrayed, which is something I think is missing in the final scene of Frozen, among other scenes in Frozen. I don't think that's the point, but again, that's a comparison, I think, that I think sure proves it there. That emotion that lends its weight to each scene, I think, is just extremely well done in the series. Last but not least is the pace of the series, and my God, the pace of the series is wonderful. And again, that's because, again, the fact that each scene has weight because of the emotion, because of the intimacy being portrayed between Romeo and Juliet, because of all the things that happen in the story that make it grand. Again, the pace is wonderful. It's just a nice, steady pace. Doing the four-act structure to where you have, you know, the first six episodes, and then you have the next six, which are 7 through 12, and then you have the next six, which are 13 through 18, and then you have the final six, which are 19 through 24, and it's that classic four-act structure, to where, you know, you have the intro in the first six, the beginning, to have sort of the build-up, that middle part to where it goes up, and then you have the, or just where it's steady, and everything's building towards that third act, to where you start building the anticipation for the climax, and then those final six episodes where every story point climaxes. The pace in it is just wonderful. And again, all this stuff I'm talking about here, the intimacy, the emotion and the weight and everything in each scene, and how everything feels real, lends itself to that play, like motif, that ability, a feeling like this is a play. And again, that's what makes it feel so real. The fact of the matter is the story is amazing. The intimacy and the emotion and the weight in each scene makes you sort of just believe and hope for hope that, you know, maybe this Romeo and Juliet will survive. And yet at the same time has them, even though it is the classic sort of tragic end of their sort of physical life, that feeling of, you know, they have lived on. You know, their physical bodies have died, but their love and their and the spirit of love lives on in eternity and is immortal. Not just in that tree, the new tree that spawns, but for the people of Neo Verona after the series and in their hearts. It's that great, again, proving that, you know, even in death, their love is eternal. That is the main point of Romeo and Juliet, that their love is so grand, it's a love so grand, a love so amazing, that even in death, their eternal spirits will forever be entwined and forever be in love with each other and forever be together. And that the story does this wonderfully with the scenes of intimacy, the emotion in each scene, the weight of each scene. At the end of the day, if I had to give story a rating, I would say 5 stars! Which leads to the ultimate conclusion. What do I think of this series? I think it's pretty easy to say. I give Romeo x Juliet 5 out of 5 stars. It is an absolutely amazing series. You have to watch this series. The music, the art, the story, the acting on both the Japanese and the English are just incredible. It's amazing. It's a wonderful series. I can't watch the ending without bawling out. It is such an emotional roller coaster ride in this series, and it is wonderful and entertaining and glorious to watch. You know, there are people on the interweb who don't like it because, well, it's Romeo and Juliet, and it's the same Romeo and Juliet story, and, you know, they die. Why did they have to die at the end? Ugh. This is why we can't have nice things. Romeo x Juliet is a story everybody should check out if you're an anime fan. If you're a William Shakespeare fan, you know, if you love just the classic feel of a play, you will love the series. It is so grand. 5 out of 5 from me. I love this series. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. I hope you enjoyed it. Remember, there are several ways you can contact me if you have any comments on this episode or any past episodes or anything you felt I did right, anything I did wrong. Regardless of what it is, I want to know your feedback. So remember, there are several ways you can contact me. First, you can contact me at absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. That's absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook by going to Facebook and searching for the Absolution Network. Like us and leave us a comment there. And, of course, you can always leave a comment on the website itself, which you can find at www.an.132productions.com. Leave a comment on the post or whatever. Again, if you leave it, and we will read it, unless you specify it otherwise. Of course, while you're at 132 Productions, remember to check out all the other 132 Productions content that you can find. This, of course, includes the Otaku Momentum that you can find right here on the Absolution Network, the Shaft Plus podcast with Gina Chris that you can find at www.shaftplus.com, the Tokyo SOS podcast, a Godzilla podcast, which I just released my Godzilla Final Wars review. It was epic and wonderful. You can find that at www.tokyosos.132productions.com. And, of course, my Comic Book Crazy podcasting network, which I'm trying to get back in order again. You can find that and all the past great episodes that I have on that site at www.comicbookcrazy.132productions.com. And, of course, while you're there, check out all our other friends on the sidebar of the site. This, of course, includes Michael Bailey's Views from the Long Box, along with From Crisis to Crisis that he does with Jeffrey Taylor, Brad Douglas' Spider-Man Crawl Space, Steven Syker's Major Spoilers Podcast, and, of course, Scott Gardner's 22 Freaks Podcasting Network, among many more, which I really highly suggest you check out. So that is it for this episode of Tom's Prerogative. Next week, ladies and gentlemen. Well, how can I put what next week's review is going to be? Oh! I know. Well, before I say that, I'll just let you know this, that until next time, my Toonami generation, I hope you stay golden. And if you excuse me, I have to, freak out!
Desert. Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off, and until we meet again, you know the rest.